Hi, I'm Renee.
And I'm Anthony. We are the voices and founders of Blue Soul Earth, where we teach and we lead workshops and retreats about heart-centered living and unity consciousness.
Welcome to Blue Soul Chats, a podcast that bridges science and spirituality. We combine esoteric wisdom and the experiences that people have had for millennia and beyond with the latest breakthroughs in science, health, cosmology, physics, and the arts.
In each episode, you'll tune into cutting-edge visionaries who are making a powerful dent in consciousness from different industries and cultures around the world.
Our interviews cross boundaries and at times break conventional thinking as we redefine what reality is, what spirituality means, and what consciousness does.
Your journey to connecting to your higher self, expanding your awareness, and deepening your consciousness starts here.
Welcome, welcome. We are here with Dr. Roland McCready, who I've been a fan of for many, many years. And as we were talking about right before we started this interview, I've seen you speak at IONS, Institute of Magnetic Science Conference, as well as the SAM, the Non-Duality Conference. I think you were even at Wisdom 2.0, weren't you? I feel like I've seen you speak everywhere.
I did a workshop there one year. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought so. So anyway, we're so happy to have you here. And just before we get started, we're going to give everyone a brief overview of who you are. So not only are you one of the primary creators and head of research for the Global Coherence Initiative, and also what people most know you for, which is the HeartMath Institute. He is also the principal designer of GCI's scientific component, which is called the Global Coherence Monitoring System and its International Network of Magnetic Field Sensor Sites. That's a mouthful, but we'll get into that during our interview. He investigates the relationship between human and geomagnetic field environments and the interconnectedness and communication among all living things. So there's our bridge between science and spirituality. Put another way, in his work, they are studying how these fields act as central synchronizing signals within the body and carry emotional information and serve as key mediators of energetic interactions between people and living things. So to simplify it even further, they're learning that our heart rhythm patterns are the best reflection or indicators, if you like, of our internal state. So that's what interests me so much about your work and at HeartMath, because you've got the data to back up the stuff that those who have always known this intuitively have always known. Right.
In fact, that's one of the things I hear the most from people is, God, thank you for your X study, whichever one it was. You've actually confirmed scientifically what I always believed or felt to be true. And now I have more confidence in, being myself about what I already knew to be the case.
It's validation, right? Mm. It's validation for an industry that is changing dynamically in real time before our eyes. And you guys were really at the forefront of this, which I love. So let's roll back the clock a little bit, because you guys have been doing this for a while. What I'm curious is, when you got interested in learning about these rhythmic patterns and to say, I want to research them and dedicate my life to this, was there a pivotal watershed or like a moment in your life that led to this career?
Well, that's to this career, I'd have to go back even farther.
Fair enough.
But yes, there was. And prior to, I kind of look at it different lifetimes. I mean, this within this life, but I don't really mean past lives here. But I was at one time an engineer for Motorola. I was a communication engineer and field engineer. And I was never really happy with, or satisfied is probably a better word, with our explanations of what things like a magnetic field are. I mean, I was using them daily. I mean, we're really good about using magnetic and radiomagnetic waves to radio waves to carry information. That's how our cell phones work. And I mean, that was way before cell phones were out there. And would ask different professors and things in school and this and that. Well, what is a field? And nobody could, they would actually get mad at me.
I'm sure.
And because I would kept, well, I want to know what it actually is, what's really behind this. And it's always the mathematical descriptions of how they behave. So we're really good at manipulating them, but we still don't really know fundamentally. So that led me into eventually, almost accidentally, discovering some other approaches to this, and which got me more into the studies of consciousness. So I actually left, I'm going to give you the cliff notes here, and get back in the, what was it, late 70s, early 80s, I moved to California.
From where?
Well, at that time, from Florida. I had a job at Motorola. I moved from the Midwest to Florida to actually do the design, help design a project there to make all the communication systems in Miami talk to each other. So the fire department could talk to the police and all different, integrated all those systems. And so that's kind of where the, I don't know if I'd use the word spiritual bug, but my curiosity kind of drew me to California. And I got a degree in consciousness studies, one of the first degree granting institutions that actually had accredited degrees for consciousness studies. So that's when I got exposed to meditation and different things like that along those lines. And
so was that in the 80s?
Oh, yeah. Very early 80s. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. That was early on, actually.
Yeah.
So that must have shifted everything for you.
Yeah, it did. And then I got involved in spirulina. I don't know if you've ever heard of that or not.
Yeah, of course.
Kind of a superfood, because I had this inner yearning of wanting to do something to help the planet and leave the place, the world, a better place than it was when I got here. So we, God, this has been 1982, I think. Anyway, the National Enquirer, sort of helped engineer this, did a front page article on spirulina.
Yeah.
Big block letters. No, it was great. Yeah, I'll never forget it. I mean, I have a horrible memory for past time dates, but basically said, doctors praise safe new diet pill, lose weight, yeah, never be hungry again. Right. So, I mean, we were the first to introduce spirulina to the world. I mean, this organization that I was part of.
I'm trying to remember when I went through the phase of, you know, my big whopping green spoonfuls of this and shake.
Probably the 80s.
Maybe late 80s, though.
It could have been later, but we were the crowd that introduced it. And so our sales, I mean, we'd built this up from nothing, you know, through health food stores and things to, you know, we were maybe selling $150,000 a month, you know, through the different networks, which is not bad, you know. But our motive was always to feed the world's hungry population. And we're doing studies and different things. After National Enquirer hit, I personally wrote about just under $20 million in spirulina sales in the next 2 week period. So we actually took the investment, the money that came in, and luckily we had a lot of stuff in stock, spirulina in stock, so we could quickly, there's a whole other sub story to this story, but I won't go there. The main point is we took the profits of that and moved down to Palm Springs area.
Nice.
We went out to actually prove that you could grow spirulina and feed the world's hungry populations. So way ahead of our time in a way, but actually did it. Went out in the desert, drilled a well, got some water, and grew spirulina, and had this giant three-story spray dryer to process it, all solar powered, right? I mean, way ahead of our time. And actually pulled it off. But did it help feed the world's hungry populations? No. And that's when, in hindsight, you know, I can look back and say that's when my idealism bubble got popped. You know, because we used to talk about, well, it's all about consciousness, right? That's what it's all about. But after that experience, it became more, it went from a mental conceptual thing to a deep knowingness.
Yeah.
Because it was,
I mean, really, even if you didn't have the, you know, the experience, right, with this particular project, there was like probably a deeper yearning to go even deeper, right?
Yeah, we're right. But that was where it was blocked at political levels. And it was really became an issue of low level consciousness of why this, I mean, it was clear it's not an issue of technology. It existed then. So, after that experience, I more or less said, no, the heck with, that wasn't like my word really, but, this, humanitarian stuff, I'm going to go make money again. Right. So I ended up starting a company, in electrostatics, actually. And that company grew very quickly. Started a garage type that, I think in our third year, we were $15 million in a year in sales, that kind of thing. So life was good. I was having a lot of fun traveling all over the world. We had offices in Singapore and Hong Kong and, doing, big projects and things. But, it started being clear that another sports car in the driveway wasn't going to do it. There was some deeper yearning that I still had. And at the same time, we were working with a lot of large companies, that, with our systems that we'd invented. I won't go into all that now. It's not relevant. And I was amazed at how some of these were big automotive companies. And I was really surprised. I was actually remember thinking to myself, how are these companies staying in business?
Yeah, I was in that industry for a while, too.
Yeah, the amount of discord between the unions and the management and even within those groups. I mean, it was, my God, horror stories. And
not everybody was talking to each other. That was the
Well, absolutely. And if they were, it was yelling at each other and judging. And I mean, it was crazy. And as we know, the automotive industry actually did have almost crashed after that and had to clean up their act. But it wasn't just automotive industry. And so I was really seeing the amount of discord that we have in between people. And meanwhile, having this deeper yearning. And that's when I was actually introduced to, through some mutual friends from back in the consciousness studies days, right? To a guy named Doc Childrey, who's the founder of HeartMath. And he was on the East Coast at that time. And I had to be out there anyway for some business we were doing, and said, I'm going to meet this guy, spend an hour to him. And ended up 3 days later, I left. Just had a resonance. And that was sort of when my really major heart opening happened and a big turning point. And I really started to follow my own, understand at a much deeper level the intuitive guidance signals I'd been getting all along.
Did they have the name HeartMath yet when you met?
No.
It was conceptual then.
Yeah. He'd been doing his research, and I won't go into his story. Pretty fascinating. And anyway, I started practicing some of what I'd gotten from him in my own life. And I can honestly say, easily say that in the next 3 months of really taking these ideas and practices to heart and doing them in my own life, I had more personal gains in 3 months than I had in many, many years of meditative practices and all the spiritual stuff I was doing. I can't say I was probably a very good meditator, but I was, serious about it. And
had you been exposed to TM at that point?
I'd been exposed to, you name it. I'd learned acupuncture. I'd learned all the stuff through that period. And TM and mindfulness and the Indian stuff and the Sanskrit words, which I don't remember anymore,
Sanskrit has a great vibration.
I got a lot of benefit out of that. Don't get me wrong, but I could have a great meditation in the morning, right? Which I would do most days and be out there zooming around the universe and whipping on our energy through the chakras and all this stuff. And before I even got to work, hitting the traffic jams, was impatient and frustrated, and then walk in the door and, I've got, 80 some employees and, the day was now, mitigating the squabbles were going on or this or that. And, stressed out. And so.
You weren't staying in the place that the meditation brought you to an hour before.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the things that is unique about HeartMath, I think, is it's very much about in the moment. Right. Self-regulation and really accessing that deeper part of herself. And that's what the skill sets are all about.
Well, in the present moment is the message of every great ancient sage, mage, spiritual guru across time and cultures. Right.
But how do you do that?
How do you do it?
Right.
How do you stay there? Right before I clicked on to the Zoom screen to meet with you, I had this download. I was thinking about so many people I know. And, I went through the whole Tony Robbins phase myself and followed Wayne Dyer and, all of these people, right? Where Oprah, you think about all of their messages that happiness is a choice. So I was thinking about that right before we tuned in today and how you know, there's parts where you talk about, you know, that the heart speaks to the brain more than the other way around. So my question is, if happiness is just a choice, how does that work with the heart math work? Well, because you could be depressed, right? And, you know, still try to make that choice of joy and inner happiness. But what does it work on? Is it working on the heart and the brain together?
I would never say happiness is a choice.
I mean,
it may ultimately be, but that's so rounded off. And to say that to somebody who's really struggling, you know, that might have lost their job or is a single parent, you know, or has a serious health challenge. I mean, that's just, come on.
Or does have a mental illness and depression.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
Has depression or panic disorder or like I say, more serious health challenges. I just don't think that's doing anybody a service.
It's just something that is really kind of pitched out there, and it's in the industry, right? I mean, it's just something that you hear all the time. It's a choice. It's always a choice in every moment.
But what we do have choice over, but this takes practice. That's why I say that's just too rounded off.
Okay.
And it does take practice, and it takes learning to know how to do it. You know, one way I could say it, Renee, is it's we can learn to take charge of our own emotional diet.
I like that.
Yeah, but that's why we have programs that start at kindergarten, right? So if you really look back at most people's lives, you know, we're never really taught about our emotions, what they are, how to manage them and regulate them, even that it's possible, let alone how to. We're not taught that in schools. Most of our parents weren't taught that, so they didn't know how to teach us that. So much of our beliefs and our worldviews and things is really hand-me-downs from generation after generation after generation. And that gets programmed in at an early age. You know, I mean, kids, there's even a study that was done, a PhD dissertation study that shows, when we'll get into this in a minute, hopefully, of how we're naturally more aligned with our heart's intelligence and more coherent physiologically when we're young, when we're kids, until we beat it out of them, right? Through ambition training and, you know, competition and all the stuff that we program.
Don't cry if you're a boy.
Yeah, all the these crazy.
Be strong. Yeah. Suck it up, or at least in my generation.
Mine too. And I think I'm older than you are, probably by a good amount.
Probably not by that much.
But so a lot of what we then have to do in later life is unlearn all of those programs, those literal neural programs, and learn some new, what we call baselines, or their literal baseline programs that we have to undo and establish some new ones.
So when you first did the research, because, you know, the data has, I don't know if it's changed that much, but, you know, what were the things that, you know, on the data side that were obvious, and what were some of the ones that weren't so obvious that blew you guys out of the water?
Yeah, well, there's been a few results from experiments we've done or studies we've done that were the surprises. And those are always the ones that have been the turning points or the ahas, the things you don't expect. So I've kind of learned to be a little bit more neutral now about predicting the outcomes of studies, because, you know, it doesn't always happen, of course. But if I go back, the first one was to the early 90s, after HeartMath had formed, and, you know, I sold my company and helped Doc Childrey, and along with some others, really help him found the HeartMath Institute. We started, we set up the labs, electrophysiology labs, and different cell culture lab, and different things for the type of experiments we wanted to do. So I already had an intuitive sense that there's something about the heart that's more than a pump, right? And I'd already been practicing some of the things in my own life, and started teaching them in my company. And man, they worked there too to really help people. So we had this is long before positive psychology movement was out, you know, many years preceding that. And in fact, at that time, in the scientific literature, you know, the peer-reviewed publications, scientific papers and all this, there were two, maybe three papers that actually even addressed things like compassion or appreciation, or, I mean, it just was non-existent in the research world. Thousands on stress and anxiety and panic and depression, right?
A little too woo-woo for the scientific community.
The natural things that we feel, right? I mean, So we started looking at kind of get our feet wet, having to learn all this psychophysiology stuff, looking at about everything you could measure. I mean, we're a very well-equipped lab, actually. I mean, we're looking at, you know, brain waves, EEGs, and skin conductance, and blood pressure, and hormones, and immune markers, all the stuff over those early years. But we were not just looking at what happened to him when you stress somebody out, right? You get them frustrated and or whatever, or impatient, but also looking at positive feelings. What happens when somebody is really appreciating something? You know, that feeling you have when you walk out the door in the morning, it's just one of those days. It's one of those days here, actually. You just go, ah, what a beautiful day. The skies are blue and the temperature's right. You may not think it, but what are you feeling?
Yeah.
You're feeling appreciation or gratitude. Typically, when you know that kind of sense, what's going on in our brains and bodies then, and in our hearts? Well, anyway, I'll try and make a long story short here. What we found was that it was the activity of the heart that was by far most correlated with or predictive of actually showing what somebody's emotional state was. Whatever they said or were, you know, you can put on the fake smile, but physiology doesn't lie. And so that took a few years to really sort all that out. That was pretty neat, right? I mean,
so physiology doesn't lie, but were you also measuring or able to at that time, you know, the energy field or, you
know, okay, that came a little bit later.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But not a lot later, actually.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, remember my background.
Yeah.
Motorola.
And you wouldn't have, you know, at least I would imagine wouldn't have called it the auric field then, but now, you know, they call it the biofield, right? Things just change and more.
Yeah. And one of the main, in fact, I'm a co-author on a special issue of the biofield, right? One of the main papers on that. But if you think even biofield, let's just even take that out of the equation for a second. Well, we can be nonlinear here in this discussion, the way we connect the dots, hopefully. So when we put electrodes on the body, right, to measure the electrocardiogram, or on a person's head to measure the electroencephalogram, right? Electro. What we're literally measuring is the flow of electrical current. That's why it's called the electrocardiogram, right? Now, the voltage that one measuring the heart is in what's called microvolts, pretty big signals, right? Millivolts and microvolts in the brain. It's 100 times more of the heart than the brain, electrically speaking. Now, whenever you have a flow of current, this is kind of physics 101, you produce a magnetic field. Mm. Now, those electrodes don't see that electric field. You have to use a different device, and that's called a magnetometer. So,
Makes sense. With
today's magnetometers, you can measure, and well, let me back up one step, Renee. One of the qualities of magnetic fields is they go through things. Mm. This is why your cell phone works indoors. You can even be in an elevator. And if you don't believe me, stop using your cell phone.
No, I know.
Right?
Yeah. So true.
So the magnetic field produced by the heart easily radiates into the environment around us. And we can back up magnetometers up to, you know, a few feet away and still measure the cardiac field, the heart field produced by the beating heart. Measure a brainwave about an inch away from the skull. Before you lose sensitivity.
So was this around the time, because I know there was a study that measured a group of people who were praying or meditating or whatever you want to call it around six sick people who were dying or, you know, had chronic diseases or illnesses in hospitals, and they were able to measure the magnetic field or the energy of the heart.
You know, that, I don't know about that study. It sounds like Larry Dossey, something he would be doing.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
But I don't think he's ever measured the magnetic component. But let me finish this story. It'll relate. So using almost the same techniques I would use in my Motorola days to decode or demodulate, what we called it back then, the information being carried by the field, well, you can do that same thing to the heart. It's the same magnetic field. So I don't have to talk about auras. I can talk to military or anybody about this because, you know, in fact, one of these books on my shelf, it's interesting. I've had people say, there's no such thing. And I'm going, okay. Well, I've got a book over here. It's one of those red ones on bioelectromagnetism, it's called, that has an accurate drawing of the heart's magnetic field measured external from the body that was done in 1886.
Wow.
This is not new, right? It's just, we just get siloed. And about every major hospital has what are called MCGs, magnetocardiograms, that measure the heart's activity external to the body for certain diagnostic reasons that's more advantageous. So, I mean, I'm not saying something that's really new, just nobody had connected the dots before. So our next step.
And also the materialists have been so dead bent on keeping, you know, any of this kind of work that could potentially link spirituality and science together apart, right? Because.
Well, or this, hey, don't confuse me with the data. My mind's already made up, right?
Yeah, kind of.
Well, that
right?
Is.
Cognitive dissonance, really. Yeah.
So anyway, let me just finish connecting a few dots here for the listeners, right? So we can measure, we can literally measure the vibrational patterns is what I call them, what they are, being carried by the heart's field. And tell with about 75% accuracy what somebody's emotional state is. Right. Now, back in those early studies, you might go back and connect, because what we found is that when people are actually having heartfelt feelings, you're really feeling it, not thinking it. That doesn't matter what you think.
Positive feeling.
Well, it doesn't matter.
Okay.
It's the feelings. Yeah, it does. But it's the feelings that are most reflected in the patterns of our heart rhythm. Because our heart rate changes with each and every heartbeat. That's called heart rate variability. And they have rhythmic patterns. So when we're feeling frustration, impatience, anxiety, the list, the rhythm becomes very chaotic. You can see it very clearly on a graph. We even have simple little devices you can look on your phone to see your own heart rate variability patterns now. But when you shift into we can call it a positive, I prefer the regenerative emotions, just to take any good bad out of it, because like things like frustration and anger, they deplete our system. That is the effect they have. There's no question of that. I'm not saying they're bad. That's the physiological effect they have. Whereas when we're feeling appreciation or kindness or compassion or love for someone, the heart literally shifts into a completely different mode. And it's not subtle. And that's what we call heart coherence.
Yeah.
Now, in that coherent state, there's a lot going on inside of our body. Things are literally becoming more synchronized. And you already kind of alluded to a true fact that the heart sends more information to the brain than the other way around through the nervous system.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. Yeah, because, you know, like you said in your data, that a lot of people, you know, would think that it's the other way around.
Right. And by the way, that's not some new discovery. That's been known since the late 1800s as well. Mm. Right. This is basic anatomy. And those neuro, what was interesting in the 1970s is when some research groups, one in particular, really got onto this. They were observing that the neural information being sent from the heart to the brain was having profound effects on mental and brain function. Mm-hmm. And they introduced two terms back in the 70s. To describe the effect, long before I came along, right, in this field. And those terms are called cortical, the top part of our brain, you know, we get paid to go to work for, cortical inhibition, it's inhibited, or cortical facilitation. So that, I took a lot of labs, a bunch of years, to really figure out all the mechanisms of that. And that's pretty clear now, and we've built a lot on those research findings. But when we're in a heart coherent state, the brain's the big winner, because I don't want to get into all the neurophysiology here. I think it would lose too many people, but basically it helps synchronize neural activity in our brain. So we can quickly clear the mental fog. So when you're in this rhythmic state of the heart that we call coherence,
yeah,
that all that neural information going up to the brain automatically increases the synchronization across the brain globally. So one of the things we can measure is literally heart-brain synchronization. When we say getting the heart and brain in sync, this is not a metaphor, right? And that's what really underlies performance, whether that's in sports, reaction times, coordination, or just our ability to make decisions. make better choices, but especially our ability to self-regulate, which kind of brings us full circle back to where we started. So one of the main areas of the brain that gets facilitated is our frontal, prefrontal areas. One of my mentors, Carl Priebrams, his name, pretty famous guy. In fact, he's the guy who coined the term executive functions for the front part of our brain.
Oh, awesome.
It's Carl, Dr. Priebram. And what I learned, I have to give him a lot of credit for what I know about the brain, because he helped me really cut through a lot of the fog, if you will, about what how the brain really works. But what I learned from him was that how we need to think, or a good way to think of the frontal areas, of what they really do, what do they give us, is foresight. Now think about that. That's something that our beloved pets don't have, right? They have great memory of the past. But they don't necessarily have foresight, the ability to understand how our actions and behaviors in the present are going to affect the future. Not a good idea to hit the boss or yell at him if you want to keep your job, right?
So there's obviously got to be a direct correlation also to Alzheimer's and the effect on people with Alzheimer's, right?
That's now we're talking a whole other kind of thing here, but certainly in terms of maybe preventing Alzheimer's.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah.
Absolutely. I can't say we've proven that yet, but there are some cases of even on our own staff, of parents getting Alzheimer's and learning the HeartMath techniques of it actually really helping get them back, if you will,
it makes sense, right? It just makes sense.
Right. So foresight, abstract thinking, appreciating that we've achieved a goal. There's so much that comes from that. And at the end of the day, although it took a lot of research to sort it all out, it's actually pretty simple. So those neural machineries, if you want to call them that, those neural systems have to be well synchronized to perform well. Right. So when we get angry or impatient or all those types of that list again, that's what desynchronizes the heart and the system, desynchronizes the heart brain synchronization. You've got incoherent signals going up. And so those are the functions that get taken offline. This is why I can say it a couple different ways. It's why an otherwise very intelligent person can make inefficient or bad choices when they're emotionally upset. That's a nice way of saying it, right? Or I can just say plain speak. It's why when we get angry, we do stupid things.
Chaotic. You use the word chaotic.
Well, that's in chaotic rhythms.
So is that opposite of coherence?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
We use incoherence and coherence to describe physiological systems now. Now I'm going to jump back to where we were a second ago or a couple minutes ago. Just kind of following your lead. So we were talking about the magnetic fields and how they're carrying information. Just like our cell phones, the magnetic fields are carrying our voice, the text message, right? Well, exactly the same thing is going on with the magnetic fields from us. In fact, I can make a pretty good case for almost all the technology we have is based on the way we work. Right.
Wow.
it's really true. If you really kind of trace things back, physiology already figured it out, and we're just sort of figuring out the technology of how to recreate it. But anyway, so we have an energetic communication system. So the fields, we know we're radiating the fields. I can put a probe, a standard scientific instrument out here and measure them. Mm. Right. And I can decode them and see the different vibrational patterns. Then the next step in that line of research was, we're still back in the 90s now, by the way, was, okay, well, that's pretty neat, but so what? Do other people's nervous systems detect those fields from other people and have a measurable response? You probably know what the answer is going to be.
Yeah.
I mean, we already intuitively know this, right? It's in our language. The tension was so thick in the room, you could cut it with a knife, right? Or it just feels really good to be around some people.
I got to get out of this room.
Right. So we were actually able, this is all published, by the way. This is not, I say this stuff with a lot of confidence in peer-reviewed scientific journals.
Over 300, I think you said, over 300 peer-reviewed and independent studies.
Yeah, it's more like 400 and some now, but
yeah, I figured it had to be more at this point.
Not that we've done that many. A lot of those are people that have replicated in independent studies. But anyway, that wasn't that hard to show. That so we think of our nervous system, which is actually tuned to other biologically generated signals. So they have windows of being responsive to the magnitude and frequencies of biologically generated signals. So, so we can actually measure what you could think of as empathy.
Yeah, that's amazing, actually. And, absolutely amazing.
Right. But hopefully people listening to this will go, huh. So what I'm really saying, Renee, is that what we are feeling inside doesn't stop at the skin. We are broadcasting it.
Yeah. And energy beings having a physical experience, as some like to say.
Yeah, well, I couldn't argue with that. But so what I encourage people to do is, you know, just slow down, take a pause, ask yourself, what am I feeding the field? Right? Am I feeding the field vibrations? They are literally vibrations. I'm not using New Age language here. I'm talking literal science now, that are frequencies or frustration and impatience and hate and
anger,
judgment, yeah. Anger versus those that are more have compassion or compassionate latitude and kindness and love and appreciation and gratitude. Because what I'm really saying is they matter. They have measurable effects, not only on other people, but even the physical world. That gets us into what you read, that part of the bio you read about me, where we're really coupling with the larger fields of the earth.
Yeah, so because the earth has magnetics too, right? So
yeah,
there's magnetic fields in the earth. We have magnetic fields, and so they're all interconnected.
Well, you want me to, I'll try.
Well, you know what this is? I mean, this, of course, my questions are out of the water now because you're making me think of so many things I hadn't thought of asking. Well, I mean, there's people out there, including people whose stages that you've shared, like Thomas Hubel, who's doing a lot with healing, you know, collective trauma.
Right.
And so there's people who are, they're healing the earth, these magnetic grids, as a way to have an impact backwards, forwards on, you know, places like where there has been a lot of trauma in the magnetic grids of the earth, like Palestine and Israel, Northern Ireland,
Can I broaden that out for you?
Yeah, because I didn't expect to go here, but this is fascinating.
Well, beans were here. Of course, Earth has multiple sources of magnetic fields. And thank God, without the geomagnetic field, Earth would turn into Mars very quickly.
Yeah.
So it's the magnetic field that protects Earth from the solar wind. Our atmosphere, the water, would all be gone very, very quickly without the Earth's magnetic field or the geomagnetic field. Now, of course, that's what our compass is tuned into, right? The North, the South Pole. We all learned that back in science class and I don't know, way back when. But what they didn't teach us, let me see the simplest way to say this. Okay, so let's time travel back to science class back in, I don't know, junior high school, whatever it was, I think.
And we won't mention what decade that was for one of us.
Please don't. And you got to dump iron filings on a glass plate and then you stick your magnet under it. I hope kids still get to do this.
Yeah, I remember that actually.
Right? Yeah. It's pretty standard. And whatever your magnet was, whether it was a horseshoe or a bar or a little ball, whatever, you know, they all jump around and let you see the shape of this invisible field, right? On their effects. But if you remember those iron filings, it's where a picture's worth 1,000 words, they lined up in parallel lines. Right, they were lines in that field. So not only are you seeing the overall shape of the field, but you're actually seeing what are called magnetic field lines.
These are the lines. These are the what do they call them? The lines of
the magnetic field line. They're actually called magnetic field.
Are they called magnetic field lines?
No, flux lines in some circles. But here's the thing: they didn't teach, at least me back then, that magnetic field lines like that, you can pluck them and they vibrate. They can vibrate just like the string on a guitar or any stringed instrument.
Wow.
Now I'm going to take it farther. Okay, so the same way the tension and the length of the field line determines its resonant frequency, the note, right, or the pitch. Okay, so now here's Earth. Same thing, magnetic field lines that are very, very long. They go out into space thousands, many thousands of miles. So they're very long, so they have a low frequency. The longer the string, right, the lower.
That's also meaning the deeper the sound.
Yeah, right. In this case, it's below what we can hear, right? So what's plucking the strings of Earth, the magnetic field of Earth, is the solar wind rushing by, which is about 1,000,000 miles per hour. Right? And Earth is turning in that. Now, it's really neat. If we were doing a presentation, I could show you a picture from fairly new data. Yeah. Well, NASA put up five low Earth satellites just to study the Earth's magnetic field. So we've got this beautiful image now of how complex the Earth's magnetic field actually is. And you can actually see the field lines vibrating. Now, when
we have the equipment to now show it.
Yeah, well, to visualize it. Since these aren't artist things. Now, when we have you mentioned this in my introduction, a global network to measure the resonant frequencies in the Earth's fields. So I'm giving you the background of what one of these is. So the field lines, they're actually called field line resonances, is the technical name, being plucked by the solar wind, right? Earth turning, so they're vibrating. Well, in frequency, when we measure them here on Earth, you know, in our global network of these ultra-sensitive magnetometers around the Earth, which are very hard to do, and wish we didn't have to do this ourselves. It's very expensive and time-consuming. But one of the primary resonant frequencies, the field line resonances, in frequency language is 0.1 hertz. So it's sub-hertz. It's less than a second for one cycle is what that means. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's exactly the same frequency, 0.1 hertz, as the human heart rhythm when we're in a coherent state.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, so now
It's not close.
It's exact.
It's the same frequency in that range that they vibrate in.
So now I'm confused because now I'm thinking of the Schumann resonance.
All right, so let's talk about Schumann's.
Yeah, and then also I'm also thinking of when they talk about the crown, the hertz for the crown and the third eye. It's usually up at what, 432 hertz. Okay,
so that's sort of somewhat metaphysical.
Okay. I know, but still, I mean,
but that's okay.
My world.
Let me go ahead because I get a lot of questions when we get into this territory about Schumann resonances.
Yeah, and the reason it's coming into my world, metaphysical or not, is because now there's new data, and I was going to ask you about this around sound as a healing modality for illnesses, sure. You know, mental and physical, you know, I know that's going in a different direction, but this is talking about frequencies, right? Yeah. As a way to bring us into coherence.
Yeah. Right. So let me just cover Schumann resonances. Schumann resonances are a completely different mechanism than what the field lines that I was just talking about vibrating. Okay. So Schumann resonances are magnetic waves that are traveling around the Earth that are trapped between the surface of the Earth and the bottom of what's called the ionosphere. So if you're not familiar with that, think of a soap bubble around the planet that starts about 50 miles up from the surface of the Earth. And, you know, at Earth scale, it's pretty thin, but you know, about 100 and some miles thick. But it's a highly ionized layer of gases. It's called plasma.
Cancer. This is the ionosphere, right?
The ionosphere is...
It's funny. I hadn't heard of this up until I invited Brian Swim to be on our TEDx Berkeley stage, and that was his presentation. This was, 2 months ago, 3 months ago? So it should be live now. But that's the first time I heard of ionosphere.
Okay. Well, anyway, it's fourth state of matter in physics. It's a plasma. Now, one of the properties of this plasma is that it's like a mirror to magnetic waves. They bounce off of it.
Hmm.
This is how, if you're familiar with ham radio operators, that's exactly how it works. You send your radio signal up, you hit the ionosphere, it bounces off. And that's how people in the United States are talking to people in China or Europe. If you get a second bounce, now you're talking to people in South Africa and Australia, things like that. They live for that. So magnetic waves that get created in this cavity between the Earth and the ionosphere, it's all about the geometry, right? If they fit the geometry coherently, they become what are called resonant frequencies. So they're amplified and they're stable. If they're not, if they don't fit the geometry, they quickly dissipate and go away.
So where does Schumann fit into this?
Well, the name, well, he's just the German mathematician.
No, that I know, but where does the idea of what he coined fall into this?
They're just named after him because he predicted these magnetic waves should exist.
I see.
So they got named after him because he was the scientist who predicted their existence. Now, they weren't measured until 1960. So this is relatively new.
Certainly, yeah, it is.
My lifetime.
It is.
Now, so the immediately when they were first measured, the first Schumann frequency is 7.83 hertz. Okay, so that's in frequency language, that's 7 cycles per second. That is the same frequency. I mean, they saw this right away when they first measured them, as are human brain waves. It's right between alpha and theta.
Wow.
Okay, now there's 8 Schumann resonances.
Yep, that I know.
All right, all 8 overlap brainwave frequencies.
Wow.
All right, now, means you asked, and then there's already studies that have been done, Michael Persinger especially did, the late Michael Persinger, measuring people's brainwaves and Schumann resonances simultaneously showed that our brainwaves do synchronize with the Schumanns at regular intervals.
So this has to, at some point, get into breath and breathing, because when we get into a theta brainwave state, right, we're slowing everything down. There's got to be a connection there.
Well, there is, but let me.
You're making me think of like a million different things I want to know now.
I just want to connect a couple of dots and then go wherever you want. So back to science class again, tuning forks. I know everybody knows what I'm talking about, where you tap one tuning fork and another one you don't touch starts to vibrate. What that's actually demonstrating is what's called resonant coupling, that you can transfer energy and information between two things that vibrate at the same frequency, that have the same resonant frequency.
Okay.
Tuning forks is the air molecules that are mediating that. Works exactly the same way with magnetic waves. You just don't need the air molecules. But here's the message. I've just provided the basic physics for understanding how our brains and hearts are vibrating, oscillating at the same frequencies as Earth's two primary resonant systems. So we have a basic understanding of how it's at least theoretically possible to transfer energy and information between our hearts and brains and the larger field of Earth.
This is the interconnectedness. Yeah.
Wow. How does mom know that their kids are in harm's way on the other side of the planet? Something has to be mediating that.
So this explains channeling.
Well, I wouldn't quite go there yet, I think it has a lot to do with explaining certain aspects of intuition.
Yeah. I mean, how do people tap into?
Yeah. Or how? We've actually published quite a few studies on the three types of intuition and non-local things. So
I think Helene Weba used some of that research in her book on the science of channeling, actually.
She may have. Yeah. I know Helene and Dean and that crowd pretty well. So anyway, we are truly interconnected. And so then, more recent studies, just to help give it one more, where we've looked at long-term monitoring of people's heart rhythms, HRV, over 24 hours a day in one study for 5 months. So super long recordings, where we could then look at the effects or the interaction between the rhythms in the Earth's fields and us and our physiology. And this is one of those surprises I mentioned.
Yeah.
that came out of one of these studies, the first one. We time synchronized the data, the HR, heart rate variability data, the beat-to-beat change in heart rate from a group of people spread across the state of California, the first study, expecting it to just be a noisy flat line. Why in the world would the beat-to-beat change in my heart rate have anything to do with yours, right? Or somebody hundreds of miles away? Not what we found. There was just slow, synchronized rhythm across this group of people. And the only thing that we could come up with to explain that was that if they were all exposed to the same external field that they were synchronizing to. And it's a beautiful overlay when you look at the graph. It's, again, it's all published.
Yeah, I'll bet.
The power of the resonant frequencies in your field, it's just a perfect overlay with the HRV of the group. So
it makes me wonder how an indigenous elder would certainly already know this, mm-hmm. and what language he or she would use to say the same thing, right? You know, because I think of a woman that I did djembe drum classes with, and, you know, she wants to get everybody into coherence. She wouldn't call it that, synchronicity, yeah. by when we're all drumming to get our hearts into the synchronicity of, you know.
Well, synchronicity is one of the aspects of coherence.
Yeah.
Coherence is just a little bit larger umbrella. That includes synchronicity, entrainment, and frequency entrainment, all these different concepts. You asked about breathing. So
that probably— Yeah, we need to cover breathing, because, you know, when you get into that theta brainwave state,
you'll allow me, we want to go to brain waves. And I'm going to suggest that heart waves are probably even more important. I mean, and I'm not taking away from the brain. I want one, and I want it to work well. Okay.
Well, that's when people can really meditate and be in a present state, or at least, you know, as.
Okay, but I'm going to take you back to the heart.
All right, okay. We're going to retrain my brain.
It's when we get heart coherent, that's what synchronizes the brain, and we get the heart and brain in sync. Now, I'm going to,
So it's the other way around.
Well, it's both. It's a complex system that are always interacting. That's what's really going on. But this one other thing I just wanted to say, you know how I was talking about Schumann resonances and the magnetic field lines? Well, the scale of Earth, this is, I don't know if it means anything, but it's really interesting. So remember how I was talking about if we measure the magnetic field produced by the heart, we can measure it feet away from the body, and you can measure a brain wave about an inch away?
Yeah.
It's the same ratio when we look at Earth. The field line resonances, which are the same as the heart frequencies, are many, many times, or many orders of magnitude larger than the Schumann resonances. The Schumanns are tiny compared to the field line resonances, just like in us, right?
But you're saying they actually match up.
Yeah. I'm saying the ratio in terms of the strength of magnetic power is similar to our hearts and brains. It's anyway, it's kind of an interesting.
Now you're getting into sacred geometry.
Not intentionally.
No, not intentionally, but
yes.
That could take us down a whole nother rabbit hole.
Right. So, I mean, it is. So one of our hypotheses is that all living systems are truly interconnected through the magnetic environment we all live in and through the resonances we have. So we have the rhythms we do. Another one of my mentors, a guy named Franz Hallberg, who's a guy who coined the term circadian rhythms. Another pretty famous guy who's also a good friend. He's the late Dr. Hallberg now. He passed a few years ago. But he actually is very serious when he suggests that we have the rhythms we have in our physiology and our biology because we evolved in these frequencies of the Earth, of the magnetic fields of the Earth. It makes a lot of sense when you think about it, because no matter what we look at, whether it's animals, dogs, horses, the plants all have the same circadian rhythms and frequencies. In fact, we have another project, and you may not know about it, where it's a global project to measure the electrical activity of trees. Yeah, when we're looking at the electrical activity globally and of trees is part of the interconnectivity work that we're doing these days and social coherence connection. But anyway, breathing.
So this is powerful stuff, man. We're touching on so many areas that I didn't expect to touch on. This is very exciting.
So breathing techniques have been around a very long time. And if that was the magic ingredient to, you know, higher consciousness, we wouldn't live in the world we live in today. But breathing techniques are important. You know, I've done a lot of trainings over the years and would ask, you know, whether it's a group of policemen or military or whatever, school teachers, how many of you learned a breathing technique? Interesting, actually, depending on what audience you're in, everybody raises their hand or nobody or very few.
Interesting.
And then say, all right, well, what was the context? Well, everything from Lamaze class to yoga to shooting, if you're in military or police, being, you know, to scuba diving, right? It's all over the place. Now, the reason that breathing techniques are taught so across so many different areas of life is they work. I call it grandma's wisdom. right? If a youngster, you know, falls down and, you know, they're screaming and crying, grandma picks them up and, you know, if you make sure your blood's not squirting out or something, what's the first thing grandma says? Breathe, honey.
Yeah, or slow down. Slow down your breath.
Take a breath. Take a slower breath, right? Because she knows that until we calm down, we can't hear anything. So breathing is one of the autonomically generated rhythms that we have conscious access to when we choose to. And I'm well aware there are many different breathing techniques out there. But I'm also going to suggest we can get a lot of more bang for our buck by breathing at the resonant frequency of the heart, brain, lung system in our bodies.
Hmm.
Okay, which is the coherence rhythm of the heart rhythm. So it's a
How do you do that? Is that there's a particular technique that you guys do with your app?
We call it heart focused breathing. Whether you use the app or not. I mean, if you're in traffic and you're starting to get impatient, heart focused breathing, step one. So you focus your area of your attention in the area of your heart and pretend like you're breathing through just right through the center of your chest. Okay. Now you want to breathe at a rhythm that's about 4 or 5 seconds on the in breath and 4 or 5 seconds on the out breath. It's a 10 second rhythm, 0.1 hertz in frequency language.
Mm.
That is our natural resonant frequency when we're feeling good, when we're in our optimal state. So using breath to coax the system into coherence is just a really intelligent way to get more bang for the buck out of breathing.
Hmm. I mean, that's similar to, you know, the 6 in, 6 out, right? It's pretty close.
It's really a 10 second rhythm, but it's usually, I think you might be thinking of 6 breaths per minute.
Yeah. And also the Kundalini breathing as well, which is a little more intense.
So 6 breaths per minute. That actually became popular after our research, by the way. I'm going to take a little bit of credit for that. I mean, nobody talked about it before our publications on heart coherence and these breathing rhythms. You'd be hard pressed to find a publication that talked about it before that. That is our natural resonant frequency, right? 6 breaths per minute, it's a 10 second rhythm, 6 breaths in 60 seconds, right?
So the app walks you through doing that.
Yeah, either the Inner Balance app or the Global Coherence app gives you breathing pacers, but that's first step, right? Mm-hmm. So that takes the intensity out if you're maybe frustrated or anxious or something.
Does the app also, is there a feedback loop that lets you know whether you're doing it correctly?
No, you get to see it in real time. So we actually show you your heart rate or belly in the apps and give you a score on how coherent you are.
Score.
You practice to increase your coherence.
No, but you need the feedback. I mean, without the feedback.
Yeah, you do. We could go on and on here. We could talk for hours about why this is so important, you know, and shifting what we call our physiological baseline. So that's the first step, breathing.
You guys talk about the heart rate variability and why that's so important. It seems like that feedback would be important for that particular reason, right?
Yeah, it's part of it. Yeah. Yeah. Right. No, I mean, to see it, am I making that shift into coherence?
Yeah, that's what
I mean.
So
you're training, you know, that way, you know, you don't know otherwise unless you can see it and get the feedback. Second step, I'm not going to let you go.
Okay, first step.
First step is heart focused breathing. Then you want to now consciously choose a different emotional state.
Ah.
So we can call this attitude breathing or we have a number of techniques. But say you're feeling impatient. While you're doing the heart-focused breathing, actually consciously breathe in a feeling of patience.
That goes back to choice. I mean, it's not exactly the same thing.
Now, this is where choice comes in, but that's why it's just too rounded off to say.
I agree.
We got to give people the steps and the how-to and the whys. Because it's easy to teach one of these techniques. We can do it in a few minutes.
Because otherwise, just saying it's a choice feels like a Band-Aid fix to something that people
are. Or disrespectful to somebody who's in a really hard time. And it's not helpful at all.
So say you're going through, let's make it something more severe than impatience on the road. Let's say you just heard your grandmother died. Mm-hmm. So you're going into a state of trauma or, you know, whatever it is. So you do the breathing. And then the second step would be choosing the opposite of.
Well, in that case, you know, I would probably recommend, there's a natural grieving process that people are going to go through. That's legal. But we just don't want to get too sucked down, you know, through whether it's loss of a loved one, like a grandparent or something. Again, we don't want to just round things off here because, you know, those can be tough.
Yeah.
But breathing, it may be a breathing appreciation for who they were and what they did in your life.
Yeah, that's what would make sense, right? Yeah. It's just, you know, to honor them and feel the love rather than the loss, even though obviously they've got to go through the grieving process. And honor that grieving process, you can still, and I, you know, I'm sure that must have a positive impact.
Well, it absolutely does. In fact, heart math is used in those kind of, in fact, he's done some studies on the grieving process and these types of things, so.
But it sounds like, you know, I mean, for at least day-to-day stuff, when we're kind of going in and out of all of these emotions throughout the course of our day, it's really a way to regulate.
Yeah. So that's the whole point. And we haven't gotten into any of their techniques really. Most of the heart math techniques, there's about 8 core techniques, 7 out of the 8 are in the moment techniques you use when you're starting to feel triggered, or to prep before you go into a meeting that's stressful or a phone call. So we can really start maintaining that. We start flowing through the day with more grace, more ease, more composure. So we're not constantly getting bounced out of our own center and our capacity to self-regulate by these things that are going on externally. That we can't change that.
Right, but you can change the triggers. You can change triggered.
The only thing we can change, you're all over it there, is how we respond to those things. Yeah. And that's, you can't just say that to people. They need to know how to do it.
It's huge. I mean, that's what everybody wants is how do I, you know, even in the work that we do, the number one question is how do I not get triggered by, you know, whether it's my partner, my child, my job, my boss, all of these things, you know.
Well, we have a lot of programs that'll help people exactly know how to do that.
So 8 steps, right? So can we
eight techniques.
8 techniques. Okay. So the first one was the breathing.
Well, that is the first step of one of the techniques. All right. So that the technique I can guide you through is called shift and lift. It's a 3-step technique.
Okay.
I can just step 1 is heart focused breathing. I already talked about that. You focus your attention in the area of the heart. Imagine your breath is flowing in and out of your heart or chest area. Breathing a little slower and deeper than usual. Find an easy rhythm that's comfortable. Step 2. This is a technique that you use, by the way, like when you're talking to someone or on the phone or in person. You can do it with your eyes open. Nobody needs to know you're doing it. Okay. Step 2. Activate feelings of kindness, appreciation, genuine connection, or an attitude of deep listening.
Nice.
So while you're doing the heart-focused breathing, you're consciously activating those types of feelings. So for a deep connection with someone or not, you know. And then step 3, radiate these heart qualities to raise your vibration and help lift the energy field environment that surrounds you.
So you're having a ripple effect on everyone else. This is a participatory universe.
Yeah. And we teach this technique to corporations and school. I mean, it's amazing.
That was one of my questions. So I'm glad you're bringing that up. How are you using this in corporations and organizations?
Well, yeah, corporations, schools, military. I mean, I'm honored to say we developed the resilience program for the U.S. Navy.
Oh, great.
For their highest stress job that they had, but that was a few years ago. Police officers, it's really in that audience, we really put it in the context of how do you maintain your composure, you know, in a chaotic world or when the blanks hit in the fan, you know.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, especially with what's been happening over the last few years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Timely and relevant for sure.
Yeah. And for a lot of people, it's just driving through traffic. You know, I mean, that's one of the big stresses is traffic jams and traffic stress. And this is a way that, we had a traffic jam, getting frustrated or impatient. All that does is change our biochemistry, you know, that increases aging. It's not going to make the traffic move any faster.
Yeah. Right. It does increase aging. There's data. Well,
absolutely. So here, these are techniques that you can do, right? You know, turn the radio on, do something different, you know, I mean, self-regulate.
Break a pattern that is making you spin out, as they say.
Yeah. So, I mean, you disrupt the old default patterns. That's when we get into what I was kind of talking about earlier about baselines that we have, our internal programs. does. Now, this, I'll just leave us with maybe one interesting fact, actually, that, again, back to Dr. Prebram proved that, I'm just going to keep it really simple, and we could do a whole probably episode on this, but that the way the brain works is it's pattern recognition, and has patterns that it's that are familiar. And you can't, the only way to change a familiar reference pattern is to change the inputs from the body, the heart in particular, to the brain. You can't think yourself into a new baseline, not directly.
Bruce Lipton talks about this too. I think he uses the analogy of the broken record, right?
Yeah.
That it's just not going to work because it's like literally the preconditioning is too set.
Yeah. But we can change it by changing the activity of the heart.
Wow. Yeah.
Within a relatively short period, actually.
So it sounds like there's been more proven data points, whether it's independent studies or not, or just the stuff that you guys are doing in the lab with small groups, that is really like pointing to example after example where this is working really effectively every day.
400 plus studies, you know,
wow.
Studies and, you know, everything and many different health challenges. You know, there's been studies in diabetes, heart failure, arrhythmias. I mean, the list goes on.
We went down a really interesting path that I didn't expect to take. And that was with the Earth's magnetic fields, which is not a direction I expected. And so, yeah, that was fascinating. I think it's going to be fascinating for a lot of listeners too, because, you know, that isn't the normal path that you talk about on stage. Any parting words for people who are listening?
Well, yes.
Any books that you're working on? Movies?
Well, actually, I would recommend a book. We have just republished. It's a very updated version of the book called Heart Intelligence that I'm one of the co-authors on with Doc Childry and two of the other HeartMath folks here. I would highly recommend that if you really want to get into the how-to. I'm hearing nothing but great and sometimes rave reviews from people for that book. So that's a very simple read, Heart Intelligence. And you can go to the heartmath.org site for that. Okay. For people that want to get a little bit more into the technology side, there's two apps, Inner Balance and Global Coherence app. You can go to, again, to our website and get to pulse sensors that clip on your ear that connect to your phone. Be great to explore.
Okay.
But really, I would say just pause. Try to remember to pause. Do whatever you put sticky notes up, put alarms on your phone, whatever, to take those inner pauses or spot checks, as we call them, and just tune in and ask yourself, what am I feeding the field? But then ask your heart, what would be a more appropriate action or behavior in this moment?
That's
really beautiful. Try and tap in, because our heart, we didn't get into this at all the research about heart intelligence, but our heart really is that access to that larger part of ourself.
Yeah, that makes sense. Actually, it makes sense. It's funny. I was talking to Herbie Hancock not that long ago, and you know, he's so amazing. And the thing that dumbfounded me, and I didn't have it recording when we were chatting, but he said, "Of course, we all have access to the universe." Mm-hmm. You know, spoken by one of the most famous jazz musicians, and that's that field that you're talking about. You know, other people, may George Lucas, to all of these people who are creating, we may not use that language, but we all have access to it.
Absolutely.
That's the interconnectedness of all things. So on that note, we will sign off, and thank you so much for taking the time. We definitely went a little over, but that's okay. And on the subsequent pages, we will put links to your work and the book that you mentioned and everything else to get people plugged in to the apps right away, the book, and more information about
I'll just mention one other book real quick in closing. If you want more of the science side of things, another one of my books called Science of the Heart.
That's one I want to read.
Yeah, and it's written at about a Scientific American level. It's not the heavy duty stuff, but still, it's science.
All right, that's the one I want to start with.
Right. Sounds good.
All right, thank you so much.
All right, take care.
You've been listening to Blue Soul Chats, a podcast that bridges science and spirituality. You can learn more about our work at bluesoulearth.com, studywithspirit.com, and bluesoulmedia.com.
Also, head over to bluesoulsummit.com, where you can watch video interviews, each season tackling a particular topic. We are also at Blue Soul Earth on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and Clubhouse.
Join us for a future episode of Blue Soul Chats, where we hope to ignite your soul's journey, expand your awareness, and deepen your consciousness.
Thanks for being here, and don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and listen to previous episodes in our library.